Hey there, beverage enthusiasts. My name is Javier Morquecho, and I'm the founder of specialtysodas.com, where you can find the largest selection of craft soda and specialty beverages anywhere in the US, as well as this Specialty Sodas podcast, where ambitious entrepreneurs and leaders in the beverage industry come to share their story. My mission is to build a community within the beverage industry, so we can all meet and learn from one another. Today, I'm joined by Jordan Silbert, the founder and CEO of Q Drinks, based out of New York. Since 2006, Q Drinks has been making the world's best sodas, clean, crisp, completely ungeneric beverages that enhance the finest spirits and also stand proudly on their own. Using the best ingredients, each bottle of Q has balance, depth, and complexity. Q drinks are spectacular on their own and good enough for anything you want to mix them with. Flavors include Q tonic, Q ginger, ginger beer, Q club, Q cola, orange, grapefruit, and lemon. Hi, Jordan. Welcome. Thank you for being here today.
Hi, Javier. How
Yeah, I'm doing good. And in today's episode, we'll talk about why you started your business and give people a behind the scenes look into what it really took to grow your company to where it is today. I want to start off by asking, based on your own experience, what do you feel is the most common problem beverage companies face when they're starting a business?
Yowzers. The answer is persistence at the end of the day. That's the hardest thing. Just keeping going. It's a long slog, and there are lots of highs and there's lots of lows, but it's a matter of keeping going because if you're got a better product, one that's truly a better mousetrap, like we have and we had, you will win in the long run so long as you can keep going for long enough. So it's persistence. That's the big picture answer, and then the smaller picture is how do you get the attention of the world? How do you get attention of customers, eventually retailers, eventually distributors? How do you get people's attention with usually limited budgets?
And so, what is Q Drinks?
We make spectacular carbonated mixers. So tonic water, ginger beer, club soda, ginger ale, beverages that you mix with very high-end spirits. Big picture, there's been an incredible premiumization of spirits over the last 10 or 20, even 30 years. Today, more than 60% of spirit purchases by dollar volume are, premium plus, so basically absolute vodka and above. And it just fundamentally doesn't make sense to mix a $30, $35 bottle of whiskey, gin, vodka with a carbonated mixer of mediocre quality. So we make spectacular carbonated mixers, ones that are designed and carefully crafted to mix with high-end spirits to make really terrific drinks.
And at the time, nothing, when you started the company over 10 years ago, at the time, there was nothing like this on the market.
No, that I knew of. It turned out that Fever-Tree, kind of our most direct competitor, was starting about that same time in the UK, but they hadn't come to the US by then.
Right. So before we go into the details of what you do today at Q Drinks and how you grew the company, let's talk about your background a little bit more. So you went to Brown University, graduated in 1998, and then you moved to California. So how was that transition, and what did you work on in California?
So the transition was great, though, like any transition, difficult. I left my family, my girlfriend, and basically my whole life on the East Coast and moved to Sonoma County, California. I moved to a small little cabin in the woods with no indoor shower, and had a fellowship to do economic development for the county of Sonoma. And economic development in Sonoma is a lot different than, economic development, in a big city where you're trying to attract parts processing plants or just major industry. Sonoma's economy is doing fairly well, or was doing fairly well, and it was important to keep the economy growing, but you also had to do it in a way that maintained kind of the environmental and, you know, just the aesthetic beauty that's inherent in the landscape there, and kind of what attracts a lot of people, whether they be tourists or winemakers, to go there. So economic development was a little different. So I had a fellowship to do that, had a great time doing that. I started a organization for home-based businesses, which are, you know, micro-enterprise, basically people moving there either to, you know, someone who's an ad executive in San Francisco moves up there and works, kind of sets up their own shop up in Sonoma, or someone who's the beginning of, you know, e-commerce and people selling yo-yos on the internet. But the thought was that it's a great way, if you can make it easier for people to kind of start great businesses out of their homes, it's a great way to not only increase the tax base and increase the income, average incomes, and increase, you know, economic development in the area, but do it in a way that doesn't unduly impact the environment. You know, people aren't commuting to drive to their house. They're not on the highways. They're not, and instead, they're in people's communities during the day. So if something bad happens, they're around to help. So people thought it was a pretty good way to support the local economy. So I started an organization supporting, it's been, geez, how long has it been now? 20 years, is that right? Almost 20 years, yeah. 18 years, whatever, tens of thousands of people, kind of supporting them in the way. So doing a variety of different initiatives that supported them. Also did some work with telecommunications there. So that was by day. And then by night, I lived in this cabin in the woods, 200-foot redwood trees over out my door. The main house was, the guy who rented it to me, was a really interesting guy and a really dynamic guy. And among other things, he made his own wine. He had a pal who had grapes growing up in Cloverdale, which is in northern Sonoma County, Petite Sirah grapes. And he figured out how to be allowed to harvest them. So he would pick them and then barrel them and bottle them. And you know, they're all talking about a biodynamic this, organic that. These were, for all intents and purposes, wild grapes that no one was really tending. It was some guy retired and kind of had a field that he wasn't doing anything with. And so I picked the grapes with him, and every year he would make a barrel for himself, and each of his other pals would make a barrel. So I got to do it, and I got in on a half a barrel, and we picked the grapes, and I think crushed them and then barreled them, let it sit for almost a year, and then eventually bottled them. And the stuff was really good. And the story that I tell is that he would trade a case of wine to one of the fancy restaurants in Marin in exchange for a guest certificate to eat dinner there. And it's called Buffalo's Blood. So he would go to the restaurant, and say the server would show the wine list and say, "Oh, what's this Buffalo Blood?" And Sean, the guy, would say, "Oh, it's I'll have some." The server would say, "Well, I can tell you that if it's good, it's really, really good. But if it's bad, it's really, really bad, and we'll replace it. And that's because we didn't, not only do we not. We didn't add any yeast, we didn't add anything, no sugar, no blends, nothing. It was just like straight up grapes picked in the field, put in a barrel, crushed, put in a barrel, and bought and bottled. Anyway, I made a half a barrel, stuff was great. I had a great time by day, and even a better time at night hanging out with this guy who made his own wine and all these folk musician friends. We, grill whole goats and just had a good old time. Eventually, flashing forward to the story, when I had this idea for Better Tonic Water, I was thought that, like, wow, if that guy could make terrific wine, why can't I make Better Tonic Water? I lived in Sonoma County, and one of the things I did was make my own wine.
Yeah, and so Sonoma County is where you first got the taste of making your own beverages. And at that point, were you thinking of tonic water, or was it after you moved back to New York?
It was after I moved back to New York.
Okay, so you worked in Sonoma, San Francisco, and then 9/11 happened, and then you decided you wanted to move closer to family, and then you
I'm
worked.
from Manhattan. I now live in Brooklyn. And I was actually visiting my parents on 9/11. World obviously blew up, and my flight on the 13th was canceled. The 20th, I didn't feel comfortable flying. And by the time I flew back on the 27th, I decided that I was going to move back to New York City and help. So I flew back and packed up my stuff and drove back home. And by, I think, Thanksgiving, I was working, doing economic development for the area below Chambers Street, so kind of surrounding the World Trade Center. And first project was overseeing power washers who were cleaning debris off retail storefronts, the areas surrounding the former World Trade Center site. So I did that, and while I was there, I had the idea of the atomic water. Basically, I had a bunch of friends over to my house in Brooklyn, beautiful backyard, and it was a beautiful summer night. It was that next, it was next summer's, and we were. One of my pals had a bottle of gin, and I picked up some tonic water at the local bodega, and we were drinking gin tonic after gin and tonic. And this is back in my youth, when I used to be able to have six gin and tonics on a Tuesday night and be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed at seven or eight in the morning on a Wednesday. But we were drinking gin tonic after gin tonic, and a couple of drinks in, my teeth started getting felt a little sticky. One of my friends was telling the same dumb story that he always tells, so I picked up the bottle of Schweppes and looked at the ingredients, and it was 32 grams of high fructose corn syrup, natural and artificial flavors, sodium benzoate. I was like, that's kind of weird. I thought I didn't really thought about what tonic water was, and thought it was something like bitter or something or another. And one of my good friends, I guess then girlfriend, now wife and mother of his two kids, was drinking Sprite that night. She had like a tummy ache. So I said, hey, Sarah, can I look at your can of Sprite? She said, sure. And I looked, 32 grams of high fructose corn syrup, natural artificial flavors, sodium benzoate. I was like, guys, these are like the same thing. One just different natural and artificial flavors, and one is green and one is yellow. That's crazy. People like, yeah, I would never have six Sprites in a night. Like, anyway, we started talking about other things, just because that's what you do. And a couple more drinks in, granted, again, we have a bunch of gin and tonic, but the Tanqueray bottle was there, glowing in the moonlight, this green orb of gin goodness there. And I was like, wow. Everything is good with this night. It was, a warm summer night in Brooklyn with a nice, soft, warm breeze. My best friends were there. I was drinking lots of gin, and everything was good with the world. And then I looked over at the bottle of Schweppes, and I was like, "What a piece of crap!" It was dented. The thing was going flat. The label was peeling off. It looked like no one had thought about the product, the design of the product since 1958. And I put my finger in the air. I said, I'm going to make a better tonic water. Long story short, I did. Long story a lot longer. The next late morning, when my head cleared, figured out what tonic water is supposed to be. It's supposed to be this quinine, which is this like bitter alkaloid that's often used as a medicine, or initially used as a medicine. A little sugar, some carbonated water. But that the big soda companies had treated the thing like a soda for the last 60 years, buying their flavors from flavor houses and putting more and more sugar into the product, and really designing a tonic water that was the most cost efficient to make, as opposed to the most delicious to drink, or one that makes the best gin tonics. So I ordered some quinine on the internet, or a bag of bark on the internet, started mixing stuff up in my kitchen. My roommate at the time was complaining about, first and foremost, the mess, but he'd also say, we're gonna get busted for running a meth lab, because we had pots and pans and boiling this. And to his defense, I didn't do such a good job probably cleaning up after myself. Eventually I came up with a kind of simple syrup kind of thing, and this took a while, granted. eventually came up with like a quinine simple syrup that I could make homemade gin tonics with. And I'd get invited over to people's houses for dinner party. And I'd say, I'm going to make my own, you know, homemade gin and tonic. And people loved it. Put the gin on top, put the gin in, ice and gin, dump the simple syrup mixture with quinine in it on top, and then club soda, and then stir it real fast. And people loved it. The bubbles drove me nuts. I knew I wanted to find a soda plant that could make the stuff, because I couldn't do the carbonation myself.
Well, before you go into that soda, the bottling plant, you were still making your recipe and you were still working at the Alliance in downtown New York rebuilding initiatives. At what point did you apply to business school? Was it hadn't happened yet, or?
No, it was like kind of concurrent. I applied to business school. So the job was spectacular for a while. I would come up with ideas and then get them funded and then get them implemented. I did some awesome things. But about two and a half years in, it started getting really political. And the money, a bunch of big companies came in and started making sure the money went the way they wanted to go, and some of the politicians stopped allowing decisions to be made really, really quickly, and it just became more of a quagmire than an exciting place to do. So that's when I went back to business school. And honestly, I didn't have the idea to do the tonic. I didn't go back to business school to start a tonic water company, certainly. I went back to business school because I didn't want to be beholden to like where the government wanted to put the money. I wanted to build and do really interesting, incredible things. And I thought being in business school would enable me to kind of have more control over what I could do.
And you were still tinkering with the tonic water idea in business school?
Correct.
And you were full-time business school or working day?
Full-time. Okay. Full-time.
And while you're making your recipe, you met one of your professors, Barry Nailbuff, and what did you talk to him about?
So Barry is the one of the founders of Honest Tea, along with Seth Godin. He's also an incredible guy in a lot of ways, incredibly smart, but also really wonderful about supporting students and young people's entrepreneurial kind of thoughts, and he's very, very open-minded and very excited about new things. So I told him about this, and he got excited about it. And I told him I wanted to do an independent study. This was, I guess, the beginning of my second year of business school. My first year of business school was not what I was hoping it to be. It was very rigid and very academic. And a lot of like doing problem sets, rather than trying to figure out what problems are and trying to figure out how to solve them. It was doing like math homework, which I guess is important, but it's not the way you're going to build a great company. So I had a great summer internship at business school. I went down to Panama, and I came back and worked in real estate slash economic development in the colonial old quarter of Panama City. And I came back and I said, you know what? I don't want to be doing math homework. I want to figure out how to do wonderful things. And I had this idea for the tonic water company that I was fiddling around with. And I told Barry about it. And he said, sounds interesting. I'd be happy to do an independent study, but I don't want you to write a 100-page business plan. What the hardest thing is for you is going to be is figuring out how to make the thing. So here's what I want you to do. This is, you got one assignment, and it's on the last day of the year. I want you to be able to put a bottle on my desk. So you got to figure out how to make it. So that's when I started calling different soda plants. And eventually one soda plant up in Worcester, Massachusetts made the mistake of picking up the phone. And I was about to ask him a question. I said, you know what, can I come up and ask you this question in person? So basically, I spent that year commuting up to Worcester. Every time I would have a question, I would ask him, but I would just drive up rather than call him. And that, first of all, because I was in school and I had the time to do that. But second of all, now that I've spent a lot of time in soda plants, I see that no one ever picks up the phone, ever. So once I kind of had an opportunity to talk to the guy, I would just drive up there and have an in-person conversation every time I was there. And so that's when I started working with a soda plant and making a prototype.
And this was a ginseng up bottle.
Correct. Paolo. Sorry, I just got a text.
Okay.
Yeah, Paolo.
Yeah, and this was the only company that responded to you, or there were other ones too?
This was the only one. Like, I called a bunch. No one called me back. He just picked up the phone once. Paolo De Silva is a great, great guy. And a bunch of other small beverage brands have started with him. And he's just, in retrospect, kind of known for giving the small guy the chance. But he's just a wonderful, wonderful person.
When you went up to the bottling plant, what kind of questions were you asking? And what did you learn that you needed to do to make your first bottle?
The short answer is everything. The longer answer is carbonation, preservation techniques, how to commercialize the product, I guess is the long short of it. It's like one thing to make something in your kitchen, but with a carbonated beverage, it all matters whether you can make it on the line. Especially because we were trying to do things that other people weren't doing. We didn't want to, first of all, I wanted a lot of carbonation. We treat carbonation like an ingredient, and each of our flavors has a different carbonation level, all of which are much higher than most other factory mixers. We also don't want to use sodium benzoate or other preservatives, so we have to figure out how to kind of balance the product in order to not do that. And that's a little technical. And then at the end of the day, I wanted it to taste fantastic. Not only the first day you produce it, but a year or two later as well.
Yeah. And at the time you wanted to, you wanted a lot of carbonation, so you had to get thicker bottles. Where did you find the bottles?
Ultimately we had them made by Vitro Packaging, now Owens, Illinois. They have a custom mold and we made them.
And you had to come up with your designs. So at the time, you were thinking of silk screening the design. Can you talk about that experience? And then after, how you met Jonah?
Johan.
Oh, yeah, Johan.
So you want both stories or just the Johan story?
Both stories. First the silk screen and then the Johan.
So, yeah, my first designer. In retrospect, everything's my fault, right? But we came up with a design that was much better on a paper label than silkscreen. And I got it. I found a silkscreener in Queens who would do it and had it silkscreened. We were supposed to fill our first prototyping run on Tuesday. So I picked it up on Friday. And it looked absolutely horrible. Like I still get nauseous when I look at it, but I have one or two lying around the office just to remember from whence I came. I picked it up and I was driving back at that point, staying in a friend's apartment in Manhattan. I was driving and drove over the Triborough, and I was down, going down, whatever it was, the east side. And I would stop every four blocks and throw out four cases at a time. Just I knew this is not what I was doing. This is not what I wanted to do. It was just so upsetting. So I was just throwing it out in trash cans, but I didn't have a commercial way to dump stuff. So I would space it out by every four blocks, so whatever, I wouldn't get in trouble. Anyway, I threw all the stuff out. And then that night I was going out with my, at that point, new girlfriend, who's now my wife and mother of my two children. At that point, I was drinking Manhattan, so I wanted nothing to do with gin and tonics. But by the, I think it was either the third or the fourth Manhattan, kind of figured up a plan. First thing I was going to do was wake up in the morning and drive up to Waterloo, New York, who's a they're a reseller of glass bottles. I could buy just a couple pallets of the product. Then I would drive that back to Worcester and have blank bottles to fill on my prototype and run. I would then tell people I wasn't going to disclose the design because I didn't want them to color their impression of the product based on a beautiful design. And basically, I knew I needed a better answer. So I had, said I was going to fill blank bottles and not disclose my design. And then I was going to call Johan, who was one of my wife's friends back when she lived in San Francisco. He had he's a designer who had just left MAC Cosmetics to set up his own shop. He and the partner left another agency who did like the branding behind Mini Cooper and things like that. So they put up a shingle and no one was calling them yet. So I called them up and I think I was one of their first customers. But I told them my issue and worked with him very, very closely to design a bottle that was as beautiful as the liquid we were putting in.
And this
Johan, the company's our leading. They're wonderful. They're absolutely blowing up. They've done stuff for Herman Miller, Puma, like literally the best of the best. Since me, which is really nice to see.
And you were still in school at this point, right?
No, I was done with school.
Oh, okay. So did you turn in the bottle as your final project?
I did, but it wasn't so good.
Oh, okay. All right. So, this was through school and then after school, after you graduated from business school, you worked on this full time, right?
Yeah.
How were you?
So I graduated business school and my best friend, who now is my business partner and works with me, he had gotten a job that was going to send him to Australia for 6 months, and he had an apartment on 43rd Street between 8th and 9th in Manhattan that I could, he would say, he would give me for 6 months. I'd have to give him more equity in the company and ultimately just clear out for, he had to come back for like 2 weeks during that 6 months. I just had to clear out during that time. So I got that, and then seven people gave me $5,000, so $35,000 in cash. And that's what I used to buy those glass bottles up in Waterloo. That's what I used to pay Paolo for the first production.
And who were the people who provided this initial funding? Family and friends, or do you have to look?
Friends and family, yeah.
Okay, and so you started with $35,000. How did you spend that money, and did you spend it too quickly?
No, I didn't spend it too quickly. I basically got a prototype that was wonderful, and then I somehow got it on some bottles, and then I used that. I get the design on those bottles, and I used that and sold the product into a couple of fancy bars and restaurants in New York City. So Milk and Honey, Gramercy Tavern, Little Branch, and Blue Hill Stone Bar. Like literally the best of the best. Would show up with a backpack with my tonic water and say, hey, who do I talk to about this? I got a better product. And eventually sold it into those four and started delivering it to them in a borrowed station wagon. Relatively quickly on, Simon Ford, who was at that point at Plymouth Gin, called me up. And they were doing a big event at Rockefeller Center. And he wanted to do Ultimate Gin Tonics, where people would get his gin, my tonic, and the people were paying $1,500 for a tasting plate to drink our gin tonics. So I said, sure, what do I need to do? He said, let me bring 10 cases next Thursday to Rockefeller Center for grand old time. So we did. Just so happens that Florence Fabricant from the New York Times was there. She's the head writer for the Times Dine In section. She loved the tonic water. She loved the gin tonics. And the next morning, I got a call from the fact-checking department of the New York Times that we're going to be featured in the New York Times. And I said, oh, my God, that's pretty awesome. And, oh, my God, I don't have a website, I don't have anything. So I scrambled and got a website up in the next 3 days. And by the time the article hit that next week, I had a website. And so I've got something like 800 calls from places all over the world where people wanted to buy the tonic water. Bars in Japan were calling me. And I said no to just about everybody except a couple fancy bars and restaurants in New York City, and then the flagship Whole Foods store in Austin, Texas. They wanted to buy a pallet worth of the product. So I said yes. I then Googled to figure out what a pallet was. And then once I figured out what a pallet was, it's like, whoa, how do I get one of those things to my house and load it up with tonic water and get it down to Texas? And I figured all that out and I sent it down there. And then Jen, my girlfriend, and I went down for 3 days down to Austin, Texas, and did sampling by day, and by night ate Tex-Mex food and drank margaritas. But by the end of the long weekend, we had sold through a whole pallet worth of tonic water. I said, well, I might have something here. So I went to the Whole Foods in New York City and sold into the Whole Foods in New York City. And I would tell the people, you know, at that point, it was a little easier to sell it on a store level at Whole Foods then than it is now. But I sold in to the stores and, you know, said, I'll do a demo and I'll keep doing demos until it sells through. So I did it and it went well. Eventually, relatively quickly on, I got expanded out to the whole region and kept doing the demos. I did something like 28 demos in 29 days or something ridiculous, but started to create some momentum is the answer.
And all of this is still with just the 200 cases, or did you already have to do a second production run?
So the Whole Foods in Austin, Texas was the first batch. I believe, you know, it's been 10 years now, but I believe the Whole Foods in New York City were a second batch. I convinced Ben at that point had come home, and I convinced him to quit his real job and come work for my fake job. And he set up the kind of production side of it, and I would do the sales and marketing side. But I believe that was the second run we did. Okay. And these runs were hellacious. Nothing ever went as well as it should. Started at 5 in the morning, which is a little tough if you're used to going out until 1 or 2 in the morning selling to bars and restaurants. It would last a week and be a lot of physical labor, which was fun and gratifying, but certainly draining. But yeah, I think it was probably the second run with Whole Foods. Mm-hmm.
And were these initial first run and second run, were you selling at a profit or break even?
If you ask me or if you ask Ben, the answer is no. We're probably losing money on every bottle. We had a gorgeous design. We also had no economies of scale. So we were probably losing money on every bottle.
Okay, and you're losing money and you still had just that $3,500.
$35,000. At some point, I think after that New York Times article, and again, it's been a long time, but I think after that New York Times article, I had the New York Times article, I had Gramsci Tavern, Milk and Honey, and Whole Foods. I then went out and raised some money, and I raised about $500,000.
Okay. How did you raise this money?
I had a friend who worked from summer camp who worked at a hedge fund. And his bosses put in a bunch of the money. They had like a thing they do, like an investment thing they do on the side for like fun investments. And the concept everybody gets from day one, everybody got the concept. Like, oh, you drink better gin, you should have better tonic water. So everybody got it. They obviously saw the circles under my eyes, so they knew I was going to work my tail off. Took a bet on it, and so they put, yeah. Yeah, it was a little less than $500,000, and not all of it was from them, but they put in, I believe, the majority and certainly led it.
At this point, you had already raised money. This is your second time raising money. What kind of legal structure did you have in place? What kind of support did you have? How did you know what to do to raise money and to give each person equity, or were they doing it as a loan?
So it was equity. It was straight... I forget if it was common or for preferred. I believe the first one was preferred. And that was because, I can clearly look that up, but the reason for that was because the one of the things I remembered at business school said that they told me that the entrepreneur should always do preferred, because that's what you're supposed to do. This thing goes down, people should get paid out before you. I was like, okay. So we did preferred, but it was straight preferred. And this is, I guess, when people ask me about business school, I feel like this is where the business school part helped the most. Was in these early fundraising rounds. So I actually had taken a class in it and kind of had a sense of how the whole thing went. When I lived in San Francisco, I worked for a couple startups before 9/11. So I had a decent sense of it. We had a lawyer. The first lawyer was not good. He screwed a bunch of things up. Then we had a second lawyer. So the second round was, what we now call the third round, was a lot better. But I think the answer is we did our best. We muddled through.
What advice would you give to someone, and or actually before you go to that, how did you know that you needed to raise more money? You just ran out and the demand was there?
Because, you know, first, again, I went to business school, so I had some sense of it all, but working capital is a really big deal. And that's one of the things that was hammered into me at business school. You know, in order to sell a bottle of tonic water, I needed to buy the glass, and I needed to pay the co-packer. I needed to buy the ingredients. Even if I myself wasn't taking that much money, if anything, you need to pay all these people before you sell it. And you know, when you sell it, you don't get paid for another 30 days. So, in order to if you're growing quickly, you need cash to make the next bottle of tonic water. So I know I needed that. I guess I also had aspirations. Like, I think there should be, like, it's ridiculous. You go to fancy bars and restaurants and tonic water is absolute crap. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, you're paying $9, $10, $11, $12, $15 for your gin and tonic. That's not good. Like, that's ridiculous. You have someone over at your house and you serve them a gin and tonic water is not good. That's ridiculous. Had a tough week, a tough day, and you want to pour yourself a gin and tonic and the tonic water is not good. Like, that's ridiculous. And like, I'm not alone here. So I knew a lot of people wanted to drink a better tonic water. So I knew that was not going to happen with $35,000.
Yeah. And do you remember what you were pitching or how you were pitching back then?
I think it was, you know, telling more of a story. You know, you show the premiumization of other categories, whether it be spirits, beer, or water. And then you also just show a picture of a Tanqueray bottle or a picture of a, you know, a Ketel One or a Grey Goose bottle. And just like, it doesn't make sense to put Schweppes in there to mix with it. And people just got the concept. And granted, this was pre-2008, so this is probably 2007, I want to say. This is just a different climate. So the storytelling probably got away with a lot better than I would have a year or two later. But I was telling them a story, kind of showing them, hey, if tonic water premiumizes in the same way other categories premiumize, this is a huge opportunity.
And how much research went into what you were telling in terms of like the data of the premiumization of these?
So the answer is some, but I took Barry's advice and knew that was what was actually much more important was creating a better product, like literally a better mousetrap. Like, you can have the best investor presentation in the world, but if your product ain't good, you got no shot. And then probably taking it a step farther, you can have the best product in the world, but if you haven't sold it to anybody, it's going to be hard. So I went around getting validation from, again, literally the best bars and restaurants in the country. Milk and Honey was like the grandfather of this modern mixology movement. Gramsci Tavern, if they hadn't just won restaurant in America, they were certainly known for being one of the best restaurants in America. And then Whole Foods was obviously Whole Foods. So to be able to show that, I think was pretty compelling. And again, that's more important than, you know, 1.2% of the tonic water market has premiumized. We expect that to get to 6% by 2026. Like, that is what you do when you don't have a great product and some great success stories.
And when you were selling into like Milk and Honey, did they just get it immediately, or what was the process for getting it into these places?
So Milk and Honey is the funny one, but I'll start with Gramercy Tavern. Jim Meehan, who at that point was the head bartender there, later went to start PBT, which is remains one of the best cocktails. Places in the country. He, you know, asked me who my distributor was. He's like, I want to buy it. Who's your distributor? I was like, distributor? I don't even know what a distributor is. So he got me set up with finance, and that took a little while. But Sasha at Milk and Honey knew a guy like me would have no idea about distributors. So I he asked me to deliver it after close, and I said, sure. Then he told me to close. I said, oh, what time's close? He said, 2:30 in the morning. So my first delivery was to Milk and Honey at 2:30 in the morning, and he paid me cash at the register.
Nice. And going on after this, you got into all these restaurants, I mean, these locations, and you got into Whole Foods, and that provided your validation. You needed to raise money. You did your second production run. What were some of the – were you still using the same ginseng up at this point?
Yeah. Okay. We still used ginseng up for – forget now, but it was a couple of years, at least 3 years.
Okay, and you wanted to do a 400,000 production run. Was that at this point, or was this
– So you're talking about the bottles. So we wanted to buy bottles straight from the producer rather than buying it from a reseller. You know, probably – at first losing money on every bottle we made, and then we switched our design pretty quickly to do it so we were somewhat profitable on each bottle. But still, it doesn't make sense to buy your glass bottles from a reseller. You can get a much lower price from buying it direct from the producer. So we called the producer and told that the minimum run was 400,000 bottles. And because that was a lot of bottles. And we saved our pennies and eventually got to a point where we could afford a 400, saved our pennies and tried to sell it to sell into a lot of places so we can get the volume up so that we're not carrying 400,000 bottles for 26 years. But eventually got to a point where we could afford and it would be wise to buy 400,000 bottles at once. And so we put an order in with our glass manufacturer. We found out, I got a phone call, it's a week or two before the stuff was supposed to be made, that we were being shorted 280,000 bottles. Like EGADS, that's a lot to be shorted, and we, you know, started selling the stuff, so I kind of needed the bottles. And obviously I was furious and asked my sales rep what was going on. And it turns out that Stirrings, which was a kind of non-carbonated mixer company owned by Diageo, had recently tried, or was about to launch a carbonated mixer line, and they wanted to use the exact same bottles that we were doing. And because they were owned by Diageo, they got preference over us. Obviously, that's frustrating. So we did two things. One, we bought the glass, or just, the difference in glass bottles from a reseller, and then decided that we were going to crush them. Which we did. On the next time we needed 400,000 bottles, not only did Stirrings not need that many, they had to have their production scheduled around our production needs because our stuff was taken off and we were selling and needed to buy more, whereas theirs wasn't. And so now we have a wonderful relationship with our glass company.
What's the glass company?
This is Vitro Packaging down in Mexico.
And so the other thing is, I'm not sure where in the timeline this is, but in 2008, there was a recession and you had investor money, but you had to throw it away.
Yeah, this is probably the third, I never count that $35,000. So it's one, two, it's probably the third round, raised almost $1 million. It was really going to step on the gas. You know, our business was doing great. We had sold into a lot of bars and restaurants, not only in New York City, but we were shipping to some of literally the best around the country by FedEx Ground. We had signed on a couple of distributors around the country. I think relatively quickly gone national with Whole Foods. So we were in all the UNFI warehouses, and we were starting to grow pretty quickly, and I want to kind of expand the team and make sure we had enough working capital. So I raised some money, and I had $1 million in checks. I'm just under $1 million in checks, and that was, I guess, the fall of 2008, and it was one of those days where the stock market crashed by a bunch, and everybody was really scared, and it was, you know, cash under mattress time. So people called me up and asked me to rip up their checks. And I had a business growing, I don't know, 50, 60% at the time. Kind of seemed like the sky was the limit. We were doing great, but we needed the cash. So I had to rip up all the checks, and I clearly could have just deposited them. That would have been a pretty jerky move. So I didn't. So I ripped up all the checks and got really drunk. And then the next day, I came up with a plan again. And both Ben and I stopped taking a salary, and we moved in with our girlfriends. And we went without salary. I forget. 7, 8, 9 months, a long time. But moved in with our girlfriends, and happy to report that both of us are happily married, both of us with two kids with wonderful wives. We kind of kept everything going. Eventually, I guess, about 9 months later, we did another round for a lot less money and a lot worse terms, but we got some cash in and kept things going. And again, going back to that first question about persistence, like at the end of the day, that's the hardest thing, is just keeping going. Because if you do have a better product and you're willing to work your tail off, I really think you are. I feel like I should be able to win this. We should be able to win this. It's a matter of keeping going through inevitably difficult times.
Yeah, so you had to not take an income. You had to move in with your girlfriend. Ben had to do the same thing. And you were still selling the products at a loss at this point?
No. We had stopped selling the product at a loss.
Okay.
Basically, when Ben came in, he figured out that our design was unsustainable. We were doing some unbelievable, like, three-step frosting process, not done in line. No, we had redone it. We were making a little. I forget what our gross margins were. They weren't nearly what they are today, but we were not losing money like we were at the beginning.
If someone is trying to make a beverage right now, what kind of gross margin should they have?
Should they get, or did they get? Like, that's a very different question. We approach our business very different than most beverage companies. We recently completed a private equity transaction, so I'm pretty aware of it all. But we kind of break even, make a little profit, and we're not huge. But we see other companies with $3-4 million in sales and $30 million in losses. Like, that's not the business that we are going to run. It's just not the way I look at the world, and I just don't think that's the way you should run a business. Some of that, I think, honestly, is colored by our experience back in 2008. We always wanted to be at a point where if things really went sideways, we could, pull the plane up and not crash. So to make us more comfortable. And I think as a result, I think we're doing pretty well now. 57% CAGR, compound annual growth rate over 10 years, which is pretty damn good. But we certainly could have grown more quickly if we had been a little more risk tolerant in terms of how much money we spent. I would say 50% gross margins is something that companies should be targeting.
And going back to the recession, like you mentioned, persistence is important. Like, and you told me a story about once you have the option that you can quit, you probably will quit. So what kind of mindset did you have going into
this? So after the SEAL Team 6 shot Osama bin Laden, I read one of those books about SEAL Team 6, and they were telling some story about their Hell Week. And there's this this bell that they have where anybody's allowed to ring the bell at any point and basically tap out, and they're out. And they know they can't be a SEAL. Apparently, according to this book, they said that they allow people who ring the bell to have second shot. and say, oh, you can actually go back. It doesn't really count if you can go back into it. And the book said, you know, often people go. And he said, never has he seen somebody complete the whole week after ringing the bell once. Because once you even conceived of the concept of quitting, that's going to pop into your head again. And things are going to get really hard and really miserable. If you've already thought that quitting is an option, you will eventually quit. So it's kind of the same thing with us. So we've really kind of thought quitting is not an option. And so that we're going to push on through and may be successful no matter what. And again, a lot of that is just because I truly fundamentally believe it's like obvious that there should be better carbonated mixers to mix with better spirits. You know, this isn't some new category of new juice or whatever that may or may not make sense. I don't know. But this just like it's so obvious that there should be better mixers to mix with better spirits. You put a gin and tonic together, it's like 2/3 tonic water. People are spending $35 on a bottle of gin. You should have a good tonic water. People putting a Moscow Mule together, you know, it's 2/3 to 3/4 ginger beer. They're spending $30 on their bottle of vodka. They should have a better ginger beer. It makes sense. There should be better mixers. And I don't know, there's a lot of other ones out there. And I think our stuff tastes better than everybody else's. And I think we're pretty smart. And I think our stuff looks pretty good. Like, we should win. So it's just one of those things I've never conceived of quitting. So we've definitely had tough days and tough weeks and tough months and tough halves and tough years. But I never thought about quitting. We just kind of believe too fiercely in what we're doing.
And when you say you had a tough time, what counts as a tough time? Does it have to do with sales? Does it have to do with not being able to produce, not being able to fulfill orders? What is tough?
So sales hasn't ever been a problem. People want to buy our stuff. So there's been times where I haven't had money. But I think the way I think about it is, every step away from the consumer is incrementally harder for us. So from day one, people wanted to buy my better tonic water. And then once we came out with other flavors, they wanted to buy that. Like, immediately, people wanted to buy it. And the press wanted to write about it. And even a bunch of retailers wanted to sell it. But it was every step away from that consumer that got harder. So it took a little while to get retailers to buy it. You know, the progressive ones like Whole Foods went first, but some of the larger conventional ones took a little longer. You know, we're now at Target, Safeway, Kroger, literally the biggest retailers in America. So just take a little while there. And then distributors were even harder. I think some of that is that I don't have experience in the industry and I don't have the relationships. You know, and I don't know the guy who owns a distributor. So it just takes a little while for them to get on board. You know, we're not another vodka or another craft beer or even another coconut water. We were something that's a little different. I don't think it's totally different. You know, it's not some newfangled you know, juice or probiotic or something, but it's just a little different. They've never been selling high-end carbonated mixers before, so it just took them a little while to get going. And look, it's going great right now. It just took a while. And when you are working really, really hard, not making much money, and you have kind of a pace that you want, which you want things to succeed, when things take a while, it can be frustrating.
Yeah. And how are the discussions different when you're talking to the larger distributors and the larger retailers? You said it takes longer, but are they looking for something different than the pioneering companies?
Yeah, they don't want just hear a story about why this thing's better. They want to see a track record of success, and rightly so. They deserve that. They have a different customer base, so they just want to see a track record of success. And like, you got to build it inch by inch, foot by foot, you know, mile by mile. But you come with both a story, but also a quantitative story of success elsewhere. That really helps.
And in order to provide this quantitative story of success, what kind of analytics or software or tools are you using to show your growth?
So it's sell-through numbers, what people want to see. Like, if someone puts it on the shelf, will it sell? And so it's not radical software. It's, you got to get those numbers good to be good. And you get access to those numbers in a variety of different ways, depending on the retailer. Some retailers provide you with that data. Some retailers, you can pay for that data. Sometimes you can pay for syndicated data. So it really depends on where you're at, and we do all of those. We have a pretty strong story. Actually, take that back. We have a very strong story to tell at this point, and it's important to make sure we spend the money on the data to make sure that story is told in an effective way.
Okay, and we have just about 10 more minutes, and there's a lot of stuff I would want to talk about, but let's just try to go quickly through some final questions. How important is it to have a partner in the business with you?
So I think very important. And I would say it for a reason that I guess, as someone who's married, makes a lot of sense. But before I was married, it may not have made a lot of sense. It's to go through the ups and the downs with somebody. And when you get punched in the face, when something goes bad, it's like great to have somebody that's totally invested in the same way you are, feeling the same thing, and to commiserate together, to think things through together, is really valuable. But even more valuable than that, it's to share the successes with somebody that when it really, yeah, there we've had a ton of successes. And if you're just by yourself, you just kind of wash over and you deal with the next issue on your to-do list. But when you have somebody who's a true partner that you can celebrate the successes with, it's really an incredible feeling and keeps you going even in the tougher times.
And what's to stop another competitor to just come in and do what you're doing?
So I guess anytime anybody else can start up a company, that's not the hard part. I think there's some credibility that we've established. We're now building on a distribution network that I think on the liquor channel side, which I think is not going to make us impregnable, is going to certainly give us an advantage. But I think it takes a long time to build a beverage company. You've got to expose your product to lots and lots of people. You got to gain credibility first with kind of thought leaders and kind of the people who taste make, and then kind of build it out. And that just takes a while. Schweppes and Canada Dry, the big carbonated mixer companies, could they come up with something? Sure. It would be crappy. It would be called Schweppes Premium or Canada Dry Premium. We've created a real sense of authenticity and credibility among literally the most discerning drinkers, and bars and restaurants in the country. That takes a while. People could try it, but I also think with our product line, there's less of a need today than there was 10 years ago, and I guess even Fever Trees, that there are some good options for better carbonated mixers. But 10 years ago, there certainly weren't.
Yeah. And what is your biggest challenge today in your company?
I thought you were going to ask me personally. That's my 2-year-old waking up at 5 in the morning. If I can just get him up to 6 in the morning, and the whole world will be great. That's the biggest challenge. Biggest challenge in my company is how do you scale up? We recently closed an investment round, and we now can make some strategic investments. And so, how do we do that in a really effective way? And how do we do that? We're not an internet company will all of a sudden put 40 people in or 100 people in one building. We have people all around the country. And how do you get them all working together and building this company in the way we know it can be built with them not here every day? And that's the really hard part. And how do you have fun doing it? When I think about where the persistence comes from, going back to the very first question, and I tie that to the question about a partner, I think the persistence needs to come from having fun. This has to be enjoyable. Like it's, some days are pretty hard, and if you're not having a good time, it makes it really hard to stay focused and stay committed. But if you're having fun, it makes it a lot easier. Part of having fun is building this company with people that you like, that you respect, and that you really want to work with. So from my perspective is, how do you build a team of really great people all around the country who are all kind of pushing in the same direction? And how do you do it in a way that is it's not going to be, you know, fun, but how do you do it in a way that is exciting and challenging and, yes, fun?
And how big is the team today?
So right now we are 16. We are 9 at the beginning of the year. We'll be 22, 23 by the end of the year.
And what's the challenge? I know, is the challenge mostly geographic, or what are the challenges of having the team be on the same mission?
So first challenge is, we're all human beings, right? So people are different, you know, people aren't robots. So we're human beings. And you just got to get people kind of aligned on priorities and objectives and kind of the way in which everybody works. So that's one of them. And then it becomes harder when you're not all together. Ben and I have known each other for almost, Jesus, more than 30 years. We met when we were 9. And we have now been working together for almost 10 years. So he and I, you know, we can finish each other's sentences. We know what's going on in the other person's head at all times. And how do you, you know, you're not going to create that type of a relationship with every other person on your team, but how do you create something approaching that where you're kind of aligned and you know what's going on, and you really feel like you're working together? And that's hard to find the right type of people. And then even when you have the right type of people, it takes a lot of work to keep those relationships strong and move in kind of the directions you want them to move.
Yeah. So you mentioned you're not an internet company, and just that had me thinking, going back when you first were making your beverages, you just threw up a website and you didn't think much thought into it. How important is an online presence to your company?
So it's a good question. It's something I'm actually thinking about a bunch because we have not yet refreshed our website or our social media presence since our fundraising round. We actually have never had a marketing person in our company for 10 years until last month. I've always thought that sales is where we need to focus the energy on. You got to make the stuff and then you got to sell the stuff. And our stuff tastes so good that the way we're going to get consumers to buy it is to have them try it. So we spent, I guess, marketing dollars on in-store demos, but we didn't have a marketing person. We had like a demo person, and it wasn't even her full-time job. She did it as 1/8 of the things that she did. And then get placed at a lot of bars and restaurants where people could have it, you know, with a wonderful dinner. They get a wonderful gin and tonic, a wonderful Moscow Mule. And that was a sales function to get it into those bars and restaurants. And frankly, a lot of those bars and restaurants came to us anyway. So we have never had a marketing person. We now have a marketing person. We should be doing more with our marketing. We have liquor brands contacting us literally every day wanting to do events with us. They know that our products make their spirits taste better. And they want to have their spirits enjoyed in the best possible light when they put on all these events. So we should be doing a lot of those. But we recently hired a marketing person. We're trying to figure out where to invest, and we're thinking about online. My thought right now is that a website needs to be wonderful. It needs to be as terrific as the liquid in your bottle and your bottle itself. The Instagram and Facebook, I don't know. I still haven't decided. We're kind of going through that right now. I definitely see other people doing it. But again, we're pretty confident that our stuff tastes better than any other carbonated mixers out in the world. And my gut is that we should be spending as much energy getting as many people to try our products as possible and not look at it on a phone or look at it on a computer. And sometimes we want people to get affirmed once they try it. They want to research it. Oh, yeah, that's why it's so good. But the question is, how much does social media add on top of that trial efforts? And that's something that we haven't quite figured out. And we're working on it. And my guess is we'll have an answer in the next couple months.
Okay. And how about doing online sales? How important has that been for discovering new areas to sell the product or to get retailers to sell it?
So we do a pretty healthy business on Amazon. And at the very beginning, we were servicing bars and restaurants and even some individual consumers all around the country. We set up a pick and pack third-party logistic company relatively early on in our company because we wanted to make sure somebody who was kind of a thought leader, someone who was the person in their crowd that found the newest, best stuff, could access our stuff. So I think that is important. At the end of the day, we are selling glass, liquid in glass, which is heavy and relatively fragile and expensive to ship. So just like never going to be particularly cost effective to service people by the case via the mail. It's just much less cost effective than shipping a whole truck to a distribution center, which then goes out on probably a full truck to an individual store. It's probably getting much more cost effective in the long run. But I think the online sales are a great way to kind of start things off.
And okay, so the mission of the Specialty Sodas podcast is to share stories of other entrepreneurs and leaders in the beverage industry, because there's great value in learning from those who came before you. So Jordan, is there anybody who you admire in the industry and would like to see as a future guest on the show?
So again, Barry Nailbuff, I think, is wonderful. Other person that working with pretty closely right now is Tom First, who's one of the founders at Nantucket Nectars. He was the managing partner at First Beverage when we did the deal with them, and he's on our board, and I think he's wonderful, and wonderful in the way an entrepreneur is wonderful. He's just very flexible in his thinking. It's very, very strong opinions, but if you present him with an argument or evidence to the contrary, he'll switch immediately and then believe in that even more strongly. So he's been really, really helpful as well.
And if anyone wants to reach out to you, how can they do that?
They can get me info at qdrinks.com. Will get to me.
Okay, and you said that you've been pioneering the craft soda movement. So is there one last thing you want people to remember about Q Drinks?
We make the best carbonated mixers in the world. They will truly make your cocktail spectacular.
Okay. All right. So once again, this is Jordan Silbert, the founder and CEO of Q Drinks, based out of New York. Since 2006, they've been making the world's best sodas, clean, crisp, ungeneric, completely ungeneric, and they enhance the finest spirits, and they can stand on their own. They use the best ingredients. Each bottle of Q has balance, depth, complexity, and they're good for anything you want to mix them with. So I encourage you guys to try it out. If you guys enjoyed this conversation, please feel free to like and share this episode. You can also subscribe to Specialty Sodas podcast in iTunes and Google Play, or you can join our email list to stay connected. And don't forget to leave a review or join the discussion in the comment box. We look forward to continuing the conversation with you. And thank you, Jordan, for being here. And thank you, everyone, for being a part of the Specialty Sodas podcast.
Okay, thanks, Javier.
Okay, see you guys next time.